I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.
At Hardee's, we love to surprise people. Surprise! We added the loaded omelet biscuit to our 2 for $4 mix and match deal. Choose from our loaded omelet biscuit and three other select breakfast favorites. Any two for $4.
Hardee's because it tastes better!
Offer available for a limited time during regular breakfast hours at participating Hardee's restaurants. Price and participation may vary. Tax not included.
Welcome back to another episode of Dr. J Radio Live. I'm your host, Dr. J, broadcasting from the City of Angels, or City of Demons, depending upon who you ask. Actually, the same city where Blackhawks descended upon us and landed in Wilshire. At least that's what they say. There's a lot of people saying different things. As a matter of fact, the station owner who was in the military was able to give me another insight. Was it drones? Literally, was it drones? That's a good thing. I want all of you out there listening to see what you think of it. Search for the videos, and if any eyewitnesses were there at the time when this happened, please come forward. Now, as you know, we are broadcasting internationally. Our home base is UPRN, United Public Radio Network, and all their affiliates. 107.7 FM New Orleans is the terrestrial station affiliated with UPRN. Not to mention, like I said, all the other affiliates. Another affiliate, Deprogram Radio in the UK, terrestrial stations in London and Leeds, and of course, everywhere else in the EU, Hong Kong, Australia, wherever else people are listening, and all the very many platforms. Now, today, we get to cover two different topics intertwined in one. Because I've never actually been to any battlegrounds of the United States Civil War, and I'm going to get a little crash course in history, even though I know about it because I am American, even though, yes, I do have Greek heritage, but I am American. I was born here, raised here, and yes, I didn't learn to speak English until I was five, but regardless, I'm still 100% American. The point being is, for those of you who were not outside the United States, I'm sure you heard of the United States Civil War in the 1860s. So, even more so, actually, what happened is what's happening today in Gettysburg, particularly. Most people know it by the Gettysburg Address from Abraham Lincoln. But more and more people are reporting and filming and even recording audio of ghosts, cannon fire, and different things like that. And that is today's topic. That's why I said it's intertwined with history, with paranormal. And we have someone who's written 8 books, coming on a 9th book on these very same topics. And that happens to be someone who you've probably seen in the social media promotion, Ghosts of Gettysburg, is the main title of, I believe, book number one by Mr. Mark Nesbitt. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. J. Thank you.
So was I right? Ghosts of Gettysburg. Was that the absolute first book you wrote?
Well, they're actually all entitled Ghosts of Gettysburg. I just put different numbers on them, and we're up to number 8. And I'm looking right now at a pile of papers that eventually is going to become Ghosts of Gettysburg 9. So we figured we'd go with that same theme for those books. I've written other books, of course, you know, one on ghosts, one called Civil War Ghost Trails, which is I got a chance to go to all the major Civil War battlefields in the country, collect their ghost stories, do some paranormal investigating on those sites on some of the other major battlefields. And then I wrote a book on that, too. So Gettysburg is definitely, without a doubt, haunted. But many of the other battlefields of the American Civil War are haunted as well.
Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned this, Mark. And I'm surprised I didn't ask you this when I talked to you before the show a little over an hour ago about other battlegrounds, because there is so much energy from all the people that died and whose souls became, I don't know if the proper word is disincorporated with the body, whatever it is. There seems to be a lot of energy of why these people are still trapped. Now, Let's get the history lesson out of the way, if you don't mind, Mark. Let's go back to 1863. And what happened at Gettysburg? I mean, obviously, we had the North and the South fighting. And remember, this is just strictly for the international people, because here in America, everyone knows about, you know, what happened in the Civil War.
Well, Gettysburg, the Battle of Gettysburg actually occurred just about in the middle of the American Civil War. The Civil War, our Civil War lasted 4 years. 1861 to 1865, and Gettysburg was in July of 1863. So it puts it right about in the middle of the American Civil War. It's important because many historians believe that it was the watershed. In other words, the Confederate Army, the Southern Army, if you will, the revolutionaries, the ones that wanted to pull away from the United States, were winning most of the battles. Up until Gettysburg, I mean, it was just a slew of battles that the Confederates had won. Of course, the main Confederate army was under Robert E. Lee, the famous general that led the Army of Northern Virginia, the Confederate army, main Confederate army, for so many years, and is associated with that army. And he was a genius, and he won most of the battles until he got to Gettysburg. Gettysburg is in Pennsylvania. The Mason-Dixon line is about 7 miles south of that, which is kind of like the demarcation between the North and the South. So Lee went on an invasion in that spring and summer, early summer of 1863, to bring the war, which had been fought in Virginia, into the North. And sure enough, he did. He was headed towards Harrisburg, the largest, so the capital of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, the largest city in Pennsylvania, and he was going to disrupt a lot of the war effort if he got into those particular large cities. But he ran into the Union Army, the Northern Army, in a little crossroads town. I shouldn't call it too little. It was about 2,400 people at the time in Gettysburg. And there are like 11 roads that radiate out from the center square of town. So if you have two large armies, the Confederate Army was about 75,000 men. The Union Army was about 97,000 men, all kind of wandering around looking for each other. They're going to bump into each other somewhere. And where all these roads come into the center square of town, that's the most likely place. And so the battle was actually an accident. Neither army wanted to fight in Gettysburg, but they bumped into each other. The battles, once that happens, the firing starts and they kind of take on a life of their own. It lasted 3 days then throughout the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July, 1863. When those 3 days were over, there were 51,000 casualties in just 3 days. Now, when I say casualties, it's not killed. That's killed, wounded, and missing. But that's Yankee Stadium. It's full of people.
Oh, yeah.
52,000 in Yankee.
More than the Vietnam War people that died from the American side, 51,000. I mean, 50,000 is what they attribute to the casualties of deaths of the U.S.
Yeah.
Army or U.S. military in Vietnam. So 51,000 people in 1863. I would think that would be super astonishing, and that's probably why we're talking about it today.
Right. Well, yeah, you did have 51,000. Once again, it wasn't killed on the battlefield or died on the battlefield. It was casualties. However, you know, a lot of these guys were wounded, and the only thing they really knew what to do if you were shot in the arm or the leg is to amputate.
Let's see. Yeah.
Traumatic injury, and then you got a traumatic amputation after that. So a lot of the guys died within weeks because they didn't know anything about
infections, right?
Infection, yeah. Louis Pasteur didn't do his work until after the Civil War, the end of the Civil War. You didn't know anything about that kind of stuff. So you had a lot of guys die. And this may be one of the reasons why there was so much energy expended in those 3 days by these almost 200,000 men that came to this small town, and then the ones that were dying, the ones that were wounded, the ones that were left behind. that was a tremendous amount of energy, human energy. They're worried about their families. They're worried about their own lives. And a lot of people think, including myself, that this incredible expenditure of energy in that small place, that may be one of the reasons why Gettysburg is still haunted, why these spirits of these soldiers are kind of stuck in that spot.
Now, what made you start investigating the ghosts in Gettysburg and in general, ghosts in general?
Well, I was a park ranger at Gettysburg for a number of years, and I got a chance to live in some of those beautiful houses that are out on the battlefield. They have, you know, some houses that were there at the time of the battle, and they've restored them and kept them, and they put park rangers in there for security reasons. And I got a chance. I lived in four different houses, and doggone it, if I didn't have weird experiences in every one of them. And the one that really kind of struck me was I was living in, believe it or not, the National Cemetery. They have a lodge there. So I was it's right inside the gate. And I was, this particular day, I was there alone. It was afternoon, broad daylight. And I just finished lunch. And I was carrying my dishes out to the kitchen to wash them, which is probably be a surprise if my wife heard me say that. I was going to do my own dishes. But at any rate, I'm walking out, and all of a sudden, I heard a baby cry. And I'm alone in the house, and any other people that would have been there were adults. And I'm like, what in the heck was that? I said, that was a baby crying. And I'm like, that couldn't have been. And you know how you are when you're trying to explain something that just doesn't make sense. Was it the house settling? No, it wasn't that. Was it the pipes? No, I've never heard that coming. No, it was a baby crying. And I think I casually mentioned it in the coffee room the next day or two. And a couple of the rangers that were sitting there said, you need to talk to such and such who lived there before you. I said, okay. So I looked this person up and I asked her what was, you know, did she ever hear any babies crying? And she said, oh my God, yeah, I heard them a lot. And she said, in fact, one time I was so convinced I heard a child upstairs that I ran upstairs.
Now, here's a question, Mark, real quick. A baby crying, that would imply if it's a ghost that the baby died when he was just a baby, right? Do you think that this was happening from maybe a soldier shooting in one direction and accidentally hitting a child?
No, there was only one civilian that was killed in the Battle of Gettysburg, and that was Jenny Wade. But I think I found the explanation why a child would be crying from the National Cemetery Lodge, just a couple doors towards town, is a building, and it was used as an orphanage. After the Civil War, there were so many orphans that they gathered enough money and decided to open an orphanage. And of course, Gettysburg being one of the more famous places during the Civil War, they decided to open it there. And this was just a couple doors down. Now, the first matron that was there was real sweet. She was real nice from 1867 or so for about 5 years. The second one that came in, it was like, you know, a Dickens novel. She was evil, and she made the kids stand outside when it was freezing cold for punishment and things like that. So if one of those children was in agony and in pain and crying, my goodness, that could be what I heard. I mean, you know, it wasn't that far away.
Now, so this, I'm assuming this was your first time hearing a ghost. That's what started you in your investigations?
Well, when I connected it with someone else, you know, if it would have just been me, I would have said, I probably would have forgotten about it, you know. But when I mentioned it in the coffee room and they said to talk to this other person, now all of a sudden you have the same incident at completely different times in the same building, two different people being witnesses to this. So that's what kind of caught my attention. And so, you know, I just kind of talked to the other park rangers there, and I've heard about this story and I've heard about this story. So I started collecting them, started jotting them down. Not only that, people would come in off the battlefield and walk up to the information desk and they'd say, are there any ghosts here at Gettysburg? Because here's what happened to me. So, in fact, that's where I got one of my best stories that actually had a repeat 30 years later. But at any rate, we can get into that later. But at any rate, that's how I got started on this this collecting the ghost stories. At first, I was just a historian collecting folklore. In the very first book, in the second book, yeah, I had all these stories that sounded fun, sounded neat, and I could use it to kind of teach a little bit of history, because there's history in all these stories, you know, of the particular site. But then about the fourth book, I got about 1994, I was invited out on the battlefield from a paranormal investigator, a friend of mine now, who asked me if I wanted to go out on an investigation. I'm like, well, sure, why not? So we went out there and had a very, very strange experience out there. And he documented it with using photography, infrared photography, and using infrared temperature gauge. And what had happened is that he said that, you know, there are these things that are seen that can't really be explained, called orbs. And they appear to be not just pieces of dust in front of the lens. They move. I've seen videos of them where they move around. They appear to be energy, some kind of energy. And he said, I'm picking up all this cold energy out 20 yards from here, out on the battlefield. We're right in the middle of a place called Pickett's Charge, which is one of the last assaults that the Confederates made at Gettysburg. So I said, and it's pitch dark. I said, well, where? And he pointed out, and so I walked out there. And as I'm walking out, sure enough, I started getting cold. Now, it wasn't that cold out. It was maybe 50 out. By the time I got to that spot, my hands were getting stiff. It was so cold. It had to be 31 degrees.
Wow. And 19 degree difference. That's huge.
Yeah. And they started taking pictures. And they kept saying, oh my goodness, look at this, look at this. So I got back and they showed me the photographs, the digital photographs, and all these orbs were gathering around me. Every picture they took, more and more kept clustering around me. And I'm like, what in the heck's going on? So once again, the wheels started turning in my head. And I said, I got to get more of this. And so I started becoming a paranormal investigator. My goodness, Gettysburg and some of the other battlefields are like huge laboratories. If you want to do a paranormal investigation and investigate spirits and ghosts and spirit energy, there probably isn't anything better than a battlefield, sadly. But so that's the other part that is kind of kept me going on this too, because of the interest in the investigating. And then eventually we were invited by the borough of Gettysburg, because a lot of the tourists were staying in one area and they weren't really seeing the whole town itself. They're just staying in the south end of town. And so they decided, one of them asked me, borough official asked me if I could create a tour, a walking tour, to attract the people up north into the downtown area. Because they had done a preservation and restoration of a lot of the buildings. And I said, sure, I can do that. So I made a tour. I created a tour. And our first tour left the center square of town on June 4th, 1904. And we've been doing tours. I just realized this year that this is our 25th year of doing walking tours, ghost tours in Gettysburg. And so we're kind of proud and pleased with that. And we're going to do some special things this year to celebrate that. But at any rate, that was the other thing that I got involved. Now this became a little more of less of a hobby and more of a a livelihood when we started these tours. So the books kept coming and people kept writing to me and telling me, you know, I've never had a paranormal experience in my life. I came to Gettysburg last summer for my vacation and all of a sudden this happened to me. And I would call them and make sure that they weren't making it up just to get the book. And, you know, we're working on the ninth book now. So it's really been an incredible me from the very first experience that I had until now.
And I can imagine that this energy and these ghosts that appeared go back literally from the time it happened, 1863.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you have, first of all, you have all the death and dying and wounds and things like that. Then you had for years and years and years and years afterwards, the veterans coming back to Gettysburg on various anniversaries, the 25th, the 50th, the 75th anniversary in 1938, there were a couple of thousand 90-year-old veterans.
I was going to say they had to be that old if they're going to be at the 75th anniversary. It's just like right now, yeah. We're losing our World War II vets.
It's very similar, yeah, because we're about in the 70th year since World War II, 75th. So at any rate, these guys would come back because they were drawn to this place. Even though they survived the battle when they were young, they kept coming back year after year after year. Now they're all dead. There isn't a Civil War soldier that fought at Gettysburg alive or in the Civil War alive.
It's impossible because they would have to be, 160-some years old at this point they were alive, at least.
155th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, so they'd have to be another 20 years on that, be 170.
Yeah, because the youngest soldier, I think, was 14 at the time. I mean, and that was even beyond young. That was someone who lied to get in.
Correct. So you have, I mean, all of them are dead now. And if they were heart-drawn to come to Gettysburg when they were alive, and as difficult as it was to travel in those days, how much easier it could be now for them to, as spirits, to get back to Gettysburg. So I keep thinking in my head, you know, it's not just the guys that died here, but it may be the guys who were, you know, who were here that were traumatized, that nearly died at Gettysburg, and now they can return at any time they want. And so you do have a lot of reports of ghosts at Gettysburg. I've collected probably 1,000 stories about ghosts just at Gettysburg, and another 250 from other battlefields across the country when I did the Civil War ghost trails. So.
Now, you actually answered my next question, which was going to be how many stories, thousands, humongous. And you mentioned another 200, 250 from the other battlefields. Briefly, let's talk about the other battlefields that from the book Civil War Ghost Trails.
Well, as I said, I was the publishing company contacted me and asked me if I wanted to do a book on all the other Civil War battlefields, and I kind of looked at it like, this is great, because I'd read about so many of these battlefields, I had never been to them, like Shiloh, Chickamauga, Chattanooga, Murfreesboro, you know, so many of these other battlefields that I hadn't been to, and I said, I snapped it up right away. It took actually 2 summers to collect all the information on it, and we had started some other tours down at a place called Fredericksburg, Virginia. Now, Fredericksburg is interesting because Fredericksburg, the town, is right in between, like 50 miles north of Richmond, which was the capital of the Confederacy, and 50 miles south of Washington, which was the capital of the North. So talk about a town being in the crosshairs. Fredericksburg was. And there wasn't just one battle there, the Battle of Fredericksburg. There were actually 4 battles within 12 or 13 miles of Fredericksburg. And you had Spotsylvania, the Wilderness in 1864. You had Fredericksburg in 1862, and you had Chancellorsville in 1863. So when we went down there to do ghost tours, I've got a lot of great stories down there. The interesting part about doing tours in Gettysburg and collecting, or in Fredericksburg and collecting stories, and it may give us a clue to why ghosts can manifest, is because the number of visuals, sightings of ghosts in Gettysburg is roughly about 10% of all my stories. The largest percentage is about 61%, which is all auditory. In other words, you're going to hear a ghost in Gettysburg before you see one. When I went to Fredericksburg and started collecting these stories, 25% are visuals. I mean, that's a lot more. And I was thinking, what in the world? Why would there be so many more visuals? Now, it could, you know, just be that people only report down in, you know, in Fredericksburg only what they see. And so that's, and there's a lot that happens to them that they don't accept as a paranormal experience. But it could also be the fact that right basically next to Fredericksburg is the Rappahannock River. And that's a huge body of water. It also provides incredible amounts of energy. I mean, a cubic yard of water is like 1,300 pounds. So all that stuff is moving by very slowly and creates a lot of energy. Water, you know, as it moves, it creates like electromagnetism, like static electricity and that type of thing as it flows through the, you know, with the air above it. They have a huge river in Fredericksburg. That may be why the ghosts have more energy to manifest. We know that they are energy thieves. Anyone who's done a paranormal investigation, we always take extra batteries, because you get out there, you just put batteries in your camera or your recorder, you turn it on, and it's dead. It happens so many times. So we pretty much know that they have to borrow energy to manifest. Gettysburg doesn't have any huge river near it. But the largest body of water is Marsh Creek that goes by. That's probably one-fifth the size of the Rappahannock River down at Fredericksburg. And that is one of the places by a place called Sachs Bridge, an old covered bridge that was there at the time of the battle. That is one of the more haunted places in Gettysburg, that bridge, because of, I believe, the water and the energy that the water
carries,
possesses, gives off, you know, so that these the spirits are attracted to it, so that they can gain energy and they can manifest themselves. So that's just one of the probably 10 theories that I have, you know, on ghosts, possibly never provable, but certainly interesting to think about.
Let me ask you this. When did you start doing your own investigations with equipment?
Well, after I went on that one investigation, I was kind of hooked. So it's probably back in about 1995 or 96. And the equipment, I mean, is almost anyone is carrying the equipment if you have a cell phone anymore, because you need a recorder. You need a camera, you need video, and that. So the basics, just about everybody has in their pocket anymore. But back, in fact, you can even get infrared. Apparently, infrared lenses or downloads or whatever. I don't have a smartphone, so I don't know what all the languages and everything. But I know that you can get some downloads that you can put on your smartphone, but. We had to buy the stuff back in the late 90s. So some of the typical equipment is like a long range thermometer, like a laser thermometer, because, you know, ghosts are associated with creating cold spots and giving people a chill, and EMF meters, electromagnetic field meters, because there appears to be some kind of electromagnetic property to spirit energy. In other words, that's why we feel like the hair on the back of our neck goes up, you know, because it, you know, that's what's happening. It's like, you know, balloon, when you rub it on a piece of wool and put it around your, you know, your head, it tickles.
Yes. Yes.
There may be some kind of, in terms of light energy, there may be some kind of infrared or ultraviolet, probably both ends of that spectrum that they manifest in, because I have a full spectrum camera, and I notice that sometimes gets better results. Digital cameras also have been picking up these orbs and other strange things that shouldn't be there.
No,
so,
real quick, you said orbs, right? As opposed to people walking that are aberrations. Do you think those orbs may be a possible soul or something like that?
I don't know if it's a soul. I think it's spirit energy, though. And because everything has to be energy. If it's in this world, if it affects us, it's got to be energy. And I think it's some kind of energy that seems to show up at, I don't know if I want to call it ghostly moments, but ghostly, you know, places that are associated with history and with pain and with tragedy and things like that. Although, you know, every once in a while you'll see a Christmas party, family party, and there are orbs in it, or a wedding, and there are orbs in it. Now, a lot of people theorize that those are the ancestors. Those are the grandma and grandpa who died years before that are just coming, you know, to the wedding. But the orbs are interesting, because I used to think that they were just dust that was too close to the lens. And I would say a good bit of it is dust or rain or snow or whatever. People think, you know, look, I got a bunch of ghosts in this, and too bad it was raining, you know, otherwise it would have gotten more. Well, that's, you know, kind of negates what they got as anything paranormal. But I did get a photograph that where I took a picture. No, I wasn't there. There was two people. One was very tall. This guy had to be 6'6". And he has camera over his head. And his wife was kind of squatting down. And they both took the picture at the same time. And they got a picture of this light anomaly, this orb. And it was round in both photographs, and they were at about probably a 50 or 60 degree angle from each other. So what does that tell us? It tells us that it was truly an orb, not just a flat disc. It was like a ball.
Sphere.
Of energy.
Yeah,
a sphere.
Not two-dimensional, so, three-dimensional.
Exactly. So, and I've also seen them do strange things too. I was getting EVP, which is the electronic voice phenomenon,
yes,
which is recorded. Yeah, you record voices and noises that you can't hear. And I was doing this in an old haunted mansion, and someone was videotaping me. And when they played it back, they saw these orbs coming out of the wall and out of a mirror next to me and gathering around my recorder.
Now, where was this mansion that you're talking about?
This was down in Maryland. And,
okay.
And we had done a paranormal investigation down there with a group. And it was very, very interesting because that told me that the orbs seemed to have some kind of intelligence. You know, and then when I played the EVP back, and it's like they gathered around again. You know, the guy kept his camera on and they gathered around again. So it was very, very, in other words, what I'm saying is that it's not, everything isn't always dust. These orbs aren't always dust. I'm not going to throw, as they say, the baby out with the bathwater. I'm going to continue to analyze these things and keep track of the ones that do act kind of strange, not like dust.
If you don't mind me asking real quick about the EVPs, because I've always been interested in hearing them. Have you ever heard cannon fire? That's what I've heard prior to talking to you today is what some people actually hear when they go to these battleground states and specifically Gettysburg.
I personally have not heard the cannon fire, but I've talked to people who have. They've heard cannon fire coming out of the woods. They've heard musketry, in other words, small arms fire, like a 50 or 100 guys all firing at once, which is the way they used to fight in the Civil War, by volley fire. They've heard men cheering coming out of the woods, and there aren't 500 men out there cheering. I heard drums.
The battle drums of what the drummer boy that leading them or so what they whatever right. they were doing. Wow.
But the interesting thing is I only heard four distinct taps. And then I waited because, you know, when I was a kid, I was a drummer. So no drummer can just hit the drum four times. They got to start fooling around and playing more stuff. Never heard another sound. I was with someone else. I said, did you hear that? And she said, yep. Four taps on a drum. I said, okay. So that's what I heard out on the battlefield. More military sounds. But other people have heard the cannons going off.
Now, also with the EVP, have you heard anyone speak in languages that are not English?
That's a very good question because, yes. And place we were down at once again near Fredericksburg, and we were at a site that was actually now it's a golf course. Back at the time of the Civil War, it was General Stonewall Jackson, the famous Confederate infantry commander. It was his headquarters. So we were trying to get him to talk, or maybe one of his aides, you know, from camp to talk to us. But then one of the women who was working at the golf course, who was a historian, knew the history. She said, well, you know, this also was a campsite for the French and Indian War. And we just happened to have a couple of people that were with us who spoke French. And so I said, well, why don't you give it a try? And so they started asking questions in French. And of course, I had my recorder going. I couldn't hear no one could hear anything being recorded, but the light on my recorder told me that something was being recorded. So when we played it back, sure enough, the response was in French.
Wow.
And I've heard that in another time too, where there was another area where in the French, and no, actually this was in the Revolutionary War site. And of course, back in those days, late 1700s, both the common language between the Native Americans, the English, the British, the Americans, and the French was French.
Yes.
Just about everybody spoke French.
Yes.
And this one friend of mine, Patty Wilson, who has been an investigator for so many years, was out at a place called the Phillips Monument. This was a site of a massacre, where 10 of Captain Phillips's men were tied up and basically tortured to death by the Native Americans. And she was out there, and she'd been there. This was her 17th year out there. On the anniversary of the battle, she went for 17 years. Finally, this one day or night, she was out there, and she was asking questions. And when she played it back, laid back her recorder, all of a sudden she heard this voice go, "Parlez-vous français?"
Speak English or do you speak French?
Do you speak French? And then so she didn't know French, but she knew that. So she's trying to answer. And later on, she got a voice, and the term Yankees actually is kind of a bastardization of Anglais, by the French and the way the Native Americans spoke it. So that's where we get the term Yankees from what I've learned. And later on, she's playing this and you hear this voice whisper, "Yankees." I mean, that clear. that clear in that. So it was a, that was a remarkable night for Patty. And so, but the answer to your question is yes. If you address them and in your, if you're in the right area, the right site, you can get EVP in another language besides what you're used to.
Now, during the Battle of Gettysburg, obviously you had the Americans, North and South, that were fighting. Were there any American Indians that happened to be occupying that area, or maybe crossed or in the crossfires, or maybe even joined the fight?
There were no, to my knowledge, American Indians in the Battle of Gettysburg, although, interestingly enough, there is one, a very prominent monument with a teepee on it, but that refers to the Tammany Indians, Tammany Hall in New York.
Yes.
It's a New York monument, and that was their symbol. However, while I was doing research for Gettysburg, one thing for another book that I did called Cursed in Pennsylvania, and what I did is I found out that, because I'd heard about it years and years and years ago, and I did more research on it, that Gettysburg had actually been, according to these records, a battlefield for the American Indians. And the more I researched it, the more I realized that there's one fellow in the 1880s who had actually recorded all this in a couple of articles. The battle, no one even knows when it took place. It was so long ago. It was probably anywhere from 10,000 to, you know, 800 or 900 years ago. It's certainly before any white people were in the in the Americas, or in North America. And it occurred about 1 mile west of what's now known as Big Round Top, which was a landmark even back then. And it was supposed to be a huge battle. And my evidence for that was when I was a park ranger, when I'd get invited to people's parties and stuff like that, and they knew that I was interested in this type of thing, and they lived on the battlefield or around the battlefield all their lives, and they'd say, "Come here, I want to show you something." They'd have a mason jar filled with mini balls, which was the soldiers, that's what they fired out of the muskets back during the battle, and the thing was filled with mini balls. And I would say, "Wow, that's pretty good. And you just pick those up as you're walking around." He says, "Yeah, but I picked these up too." He's got a mason jar filled with arrowheads. Now, you can fit a lot more arrowheads in a mason jar than you can mini balls, because they're a lot bigger.
Yes.
It didn't make any sense to me until I started doing this research that I was shown evidence that at least as many, if not more, arrows were fired at Gettysburg than muskets.
That's actually an anomaly, you know what I mean? Right there. That actually almost doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Unless,
so
would thinking, you say that maybe those arrows were there prior to that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were, he found those, and they had been on this, basically in the same battlefield, thousands of years before the battle, when Indians fought over the area. That's my personal evidence, what I saw of a major Native American battle. And, you know, if you look online, there's a map, and I cannot remember the exact tribes, but if you look at it, there's a line between two major tribes. You can't really tell if Gettysburg's in the middle of that or not, but it sure looks like it is. So that was, you know, that was basically the front lines, that part of Pennsylvania. So my thought was, you know, was Gettysburg cursed to be a battlefield? You know what I mean? First, thousands of years ago, with the Native Americans fighting, and then later on, in 1863, when the two armies basically accidentally collided in that area and ended up fighting to the death, at Gettysburg, at the very same place. So I always wondered about that, you know?
Oh, yeah, I would absolutely, too. I mean, a lot of it would make me have more questions than answers as you go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah, those pesky rabbit holes. I'll tell you. It is it's tough to stay on track, but some of it is fruitful. I mean, you know, like that, the story I just told you about the Native American fighting there.
Yeah, honestly, I wouldn't have expected to found more arrowheads than actual musket balls, considering how many musket balls were fired over those 3 days in 1863. I mean,
oh yeah,
tens of thousands, I would think. I mean, 51,000 people, the casualties. What about the non-casualties? And obviously, they're firing more than one musket, right? I mean, so what are you averaging, maybe 20 per day? Because I know it takes maybe a minute or two to load it. So 20, I think, is just a low, low, low number. Probably in the hundreds, maybe 100 per day, depending on the time. Because during a battle, I would think they have time to retreat and then go on again. Obviously, we don't know other than because there's no video. It's not like World War II where you have video of the D-Day invasion or things like that, or definitely not like modern day war. So we only can rely on eyewitness accounts and the survivors, the veterans of the war. And it would be really fantastic right now had we had the chance to have some sort of time machine to be able to speak to those veterans, even if we couldn't view the battle. But just to be in the presence of those veterans after. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you heard the story about this World War II vet who's making the rounds of the United States and ending up in Washington, D.C. to meet the president. He's meeting all the governors, and the reason he's doing so is because when he was a child, he missed an opportunity to talk to a Civil War veteran, and that's haunted him all his life, and he doesn't want to be that person. And it just got me to thinking that the last Civil War veteran, I believe, died in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken. That's a pretty long life, if you actually think about it. You know, that have to have been breaking 100.
Right.
Now, your first book, Ghost of Gettysburg, and you said you're mentioning that you're almost done with 9, getting ready to release 9 that has over 1,000 stories. When was the first book published?
The very first ghost book on Gettysburg was 1991.
Wow. So you're literally coming upon 3 decades, almost 28 years at this point.
Yep. Yep. And as I said, the tours have been going for 25 years. And we have been in that building on the corner of Baltimore Street and Breckenridge Street since 1998. So that's 21 years. And by the way, that building is haunted as well. It's a Civil War building. And, you know, a lot of people in Gettysburg, especially if you have a commercial enterprise, like to talk about how their building's haunted, you know, to attract tourists in there. But, you know, almost every place in Gettysburg has some kind of ghost story associated with it. So, and ours does as well. But it, like I said, it is interesting to be a paranormal investigator because not only is the battlefield itself kind of like a big laboratory, but the town, I mean, not too many people realize this, the town itself was battlefield. Men fought through the town of Gettysburg. And our building, which is just about 3 blocks south of the center square of town, was actually occupied by Confederate soldiers, Southern soldiers, for at least 2 days after the battle. And we know this because there were two women that lived in the house at the time of the battle, and they were both named Mary, and their last name was Young, a mother and a daughter. And the daughter then in the 1930s, when it was coming onto the 75th anniversary of the battle, she was probably in her 90s, was interviewed by some of the what's known as the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, when there were writers out of business, you know, could make a living during the Depression. The government hired them and paid them to go out and interview these people, collect this history, these stories, for posterity's sake. And when they interviewed her, she confirmed the fact that Confederate soldiers were actually in her house, which is the building we own now. And just before that, though, a wounded Union soldier had come by. Mm. So as the Confederate soldiers are coming in to the house, they're hustling this Union soldier up into their attic.
Yeah, they got to hide him. Otherwise, he would have been shot and killed. I would have thought, or tortured for information.
Or captured and sent to one of these prison camps, which was a living hell. Yes. So they hit him, and they said that, you know, they had to get him out of there to safety. The young lady, the daughter, kind of presented a ruse, you know, like acted like she was going to faint or something. And all the Confederate soldiers rushed over to help her, and the Union soldier came out of the attic, across the floor, which is, you know, our second floor now, it's a kitchen, and out the door onto the balcony, and then over to the house next door to ours, which did not have any Confederate soldiers in it. So they kind of basically saved the guy's life. And so that's one of the great stories about our building. And we have done paranormal investigations in that building, and we've contacted Confederate soldiers. We've confirmed that by history, by the maps and everything, that there were soldiers from Georgia in that area of the town. So we assume that that's what the soldiers that were at our building. And so we've talked to soldiers. I've asked, have you ever been to Atlanta? And I've gotten answers. We know that there's one other soldier who kind of stands on guard. We've had two of our employees, literally, after they've turned the lights out, run into this guy in what we call the green room, the middle room, as they're leaving the building. They describe him. One of the women that ran into him was ex-military. She said he went on guard, you know, with his rifle when I walked into the room.
Literally, the other a sentry, a ghost of sentry.
Absolutely, a sentry. And what we're assuming from this is that one of the things that he was told, because we know the downstairs was probably the wounded soldiers that were down there because they couldn't climb up to the second floor and they just needed to get out of the sun. And he was probably told, guard these men. They're helpless. They're wounded. They can't do anything. And so he did his best to guard these, and he's still on duty. The two women said, both of them said that he's huge. He's linebacker size. He's a big guy. And they literally had to walk around him to get out of our building. So it was that's the other ghost that we have in there. And then we have Mrs. Kitzmiller. The Kitzmillers owned our building longer than anybody, from 1866, right after the war, 1914. And
almost,
of course, in those days,
50 years, 48 years right yeah. there.
Yeah. And so in those days, you didn't go to a hospital or a hospice to die, or you died in your house.
Yes.
And we know that several of them passed away in that building, including kind of a little bit of a mystery. We know they had at least three children. And Mr. Kitzmiller died before his wife did. So she was there with maybe one child taken care of, but the other two children died there. And then there's this mysterious gravestone in the cemetery because, you know, they're buried 400 yards from that house in the Citizen Cemetery at Gettysburg on Cemetery Hill. And there's a tombstone among the rest of the family. And the tombstone, all it has on it across the top is it says, Babes. In other words, two babies.
Oh,
and who knows? Yeah, who knows whether they were twins that were stillborn or whether they you know, reopened the grave after the second child died.
No one knows. I was just going to say, if they're not twins, I mean, to have a grave for two individuals, whether it be adults or children, they either died in close proximity, were twins, or like you said, stillborn at different times, and like you said, reopen the grave, which probably would have been a ghastly sight. Can you imagine if a few years had gone by, or even just 9 months of decomposition? This is long before we started embalming people in those days. That's why you had to bury them so darn quickly.
Yeah, well, it couldn't have been pleasant for the parents. I mean, you have to think about that. But that also means that at least two more children died in that house. So we have a lot of, there's a lot of history that points to the fact that there's a reason why we have ghosts in our building. And it's also a good place to do a paranormal investigation, because I can lock it down. You know what I mean? I know where all the creaks and the groans and moans in that house are, and who to contact, try and contact with my EVP. And in fact, one winter night, I went to the back room on the second floor, which is the most active room in the building. I mean, I've done a lot of investigations up there with groups of people. I usually stand there with my back to the door, to the kitchen. And periodically I've heard footsteps coming across that floor, and I've turned around. I thought maybe it was my wife Carol coming up to tell me something, and no one's there. And one night I heard the footsteps, and when I finished trying to get my EVP, I said to the people, I said, did anyone else hear footsteps behind me, or is it me? Am I just crazy? And they said, no, we heard them. We thought someone was coming in. The guy standing next to me said, or sitting down next to me, says, I actually saw someone look over your shoulder at what you were doing. And, you know, there wasn't anybody there. It was obviously a spirit that was curious about what was happening to me or what I was doing. But one night in the wintertime, I decided I was going to make an experiment. And so I set my recorder up there and I put it on voice activation, which means it shouldn't record anything if there's no noise. And the last thing I did is I said, okay, it's 10 o'clock at night. I'm going to be in tomorrow morning. And I walked out and closed the door and locked the place down. So I went back in the morning, about 9 o'clock or so, with no one in the house, on voice activation. The recorder recorded 44 minutes of noise and voices, and it's almost sounded in some cases like a party going on. A couple of times I heard, it was a winter night, I heard a snowplow go by, so I had an example of real noise that I could compare to the EVP that I was getting. And I'll tell you, Dr. J, that was one of the more remarkable experiments I did there. And so, I mean, it helps if we're asking the questions, but apparently the ghosts don't need us around that much. They can do their thing without us.
Yeah, that's a given. Let me ask you this about questions. I've always wondered what sorts of questions and what are the top questions that you do ask and responses that you get from these apparitions, dead people, ghosts, whatever you want to call them.
Well, you know, doing an investigation in a Civil War site is, being a historian, I know kind of how to talk to these guys. And one night I went out to the place called the Triangular Field, which is right near Devil's Den, to the landmarks there at Gettysburg. And I read the roster. I called them to attention. I started reading the roster of soldiers from the 15th Georgia. The 15th Georgia fought in the Triangular Field. And I started calling out names. And I could see I was recording something. So when I played it back, I was getting answers. Like, here, sir, present, things like that. Not that clear, but obviously answers to me calling them to attention and calling their names. And if you do almost any Civil War battlefield, if you go out there, you'll see monuments. And nine times out of 10, the monuments will have the names of the guys that fought there, in many cases, the guys that were killed during that battle while they were, you know, fighting. And that's why they're memorialized on the monument. So that automatically gives you names that you can ask, even ask to talk to. I know a lot of the things you see on TV when they're trying to get EVP, they yell at these people and they taunt them. You know, why won't you talk to me? But it doesn't seem like you need to do that with these
Civil War
soldiers.
Especially if they're speaking so darn lowly that an EVP can capture, but you can't yourself. So, I mean, I don't think volume really makes a difference.
It doesn't. It's electromagnetic. You know, it's electronic voice phenomenon. So they're using some kind of electromagnetic field or a distortion of the field to put their words on the tapes, and so you can't hear them. And if you have a name, and if you have to remember, if you're doing Civil War stuff, that was the Victorian age in America. You know, everybody was, in spite of the fact that we had the bloodiest war we've ever had, it was still kind of a genteel time. Mrs. Kitzmiller, no doubt, talked when she was in public with her husband, called him Mr. Kitzmiller, rather than, you know, David, his name. So it was a little more, you know, genteel. You had manners back then. In fact, one of the EVPs I got, Mrs. Kitzmiller, kept telling, mediums, and she kept telling our mediums that she was upset because when I would invite people up to do a paranormal investigation, I wasn't giving them tea and cookies, which apparently is what you
customary.
Did.
Yeah.
Back in those days. And so one night we just said, well, you know, we looked around in the cupboards and someone had left some cookies, one of the renters before. So we pulled out, they were not, you know, you couldn't eat them, but we put them in a bowl and we set them out. And so I was getting EVP. And finally I said, Mrs. Kitzmiller, I said, how do you like the cookies that we brought out? And of course, I let the recorder go without saying anything, but I could see it was recording. When I played it back, you could hear my voice asking how she liked the cookies. And then you hear a distinctly female voice say, I hate them. So apparently I didn't please her, even though I brought the cookies out. But that's the EVP, I think, is the thing I enjoy doing the most, because you actually get some solid information from these people. It's not easy for them to communicate because they have no larynx, no voice box. You know, that's decomposed. But they're communicating in some other way, which appears to be electronic or electromagnetic. Once again, it's one of the mysteries why it happens, but it's happened. It's been happening since the advent of magnetic tape. That was some of the first EVP that was collected. Is a fellow was trying to collect bird songs. It was his hobby. And all of a sudden, when he's playing this back, he realizes that there's a male voice on it. We played it back again, and he recognized the voice. It was the voice of his dead father, who was trying to tell him a little bit more about how to record these bird songs. Well, his hobby suddenly changed from collecting bird songs to trying to get more EVP. But the EVP is my favorite thing to try and get, and I have literally thousands of recordings, not all Class A, which is the type that you can hear with no augmentation, no, you know, it's like the way we're talking right now. they're usually short, you know, a one or two or three word answer, but it's quite convincing when you listen to them and hear voices coming from nowhere.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, I've heard lots of EVPs, and I've always been, you know, stunned and amazed by hearing them, and to have the ability and technology to be able to capture voices from beyond the grave is just phenomenal. But yet we have another thing which is truly amazing, is the images and videos that I've seen in preparation for this show today. Can you talk about what you yourself have actually filmed or maybe have still photographs as opposed to other people's? And we'll get to some of those favorite ones after that.
Yeah, we obviously, you know, other than the many, many photos of the orbs that we've gotten, and some of the strange things that they do when you have a video camera on them.
Oh, especially like you said, coming out of the wall. That's one thing right there too.
Yeah. I was doing an investigation just briefly off about orbs here and video with a friend, and we had set up an infrared camera facing us. So that, you know, you like to video everything you're doing so people can't say you're faking something, you know. So you saw us getting EVP and everything out in this place called East Cavalry Battlefield, where the huge cavalry battle between Jeb Stuart, the Confederate, and George Armstrong Custer, who eventually lost his life at the Little Bighorn,
yes,
against the Sioux. But at any rate, we were out there trying to get EVP. And you could see from the camera point of view, we finished and we start walking back towards the camera. And we got about maybe 15 yards from the camera, and all these orbs came zooming at the camera. And you could see them dodge the camera. You could see them go on either side of the camera. We got into my van. And now she was a little bit psychic. Okay. She could see some of these things. And I told her, I said, you know, I think I got a lot of pictures of orbs. She says, oh my goodness, did you see that? One just came through the windshield of my van.
Into your van. I said, wow.
Into the van. And I said, get a picture. So she turned to the back of the van, took a picture, and there was an orb in it. So, you know, but other than the orbs, we have gotten some photographs that are pretty remarkable. In our building, I always knew that we had child ghosts in that building. One of our tenants heard a ball bouncing, kids running up and down the indoor stairs there, marbles being rolled on the floor, things like that when we have carpet, but you can hear them on a wood floor. So we always knew we had child ghosts in that building. And I had invited a friend who had a paranormal investigating group from Maryland to come up to Gettysburg. And I said, just go ahead and, you know, we'll rock the building when you're done. And so they were up most of the night, and they would set their cameras and the equipment up in one area and hear kids playing in the other. Behind them in the back of the room, back of the building. So they tear their stuff down, go to the back of the building, and they hear kids playing in the front, you know, obviously.
So they go everywhere opposite from where the people are.
Yeah, kids goofing on them. You know how kids are. So there's one guy, the leader's not, he got smart, and he set his camera up in the middle room and took a picture back through a door and got almost, he took 50 pictures. One of them came out, and he took almost a perfect picture of a little boy.
Wow.
And the boy looks to be about 4 or 5 years old. The photographer's name is Jeff Ritzman. And it's a remarkable photograph. Interestingly enough, this woman that had gone on the paranormal investigation with worked with us out at the Cavalry Battlefield, worked for us for a while. One night she was saying that she had was kind of in a, you know, reverie, kind of thinking about something else. And she looked into the doorway that led up to the second floor, and she said, "I saw a little boy there." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "They saw it was a ghost because he was there for about 3 seconds and disappeared." I said, "What did he look like?" She said, "Well, he had kind of like dirty blonde hair. He had a white shirt. He had suspenders, you know, holding up his pants." If you look at that photograph that we took, that Jeff took, you see that kind of like sandy blonde hair on a little boy. You can see his white shirt and suspenders in the photograph. So I think that Jeff got a photograph of the little boy that my employee saw. And that's pretty remarkable, I would say, you know. And I've also seen some, you have to be a little bit careful now because there is an app out, I guess, that you can download onto your camera and they are on your cell phone, and you can actually put a ghost in there wherever you want. And so you got to be careful when you watch that. If it looks too good to be true, it probably is. Now, I do know that some people on our tours have had experiences and have captured them on camera. There's a building about 2 blocks from ours. It's an ice cream parlor now, but before it had been a art gallery and a couple of other things. And I actually collected some stories from the people who worked there. So I know the place is haunted or has stories of being haunted. It was right actually located in between the Union and Confederate, the Northern and Southern lines at Gettysburg, kind of in a no man's land. And the people on my tour were walking past it, and they tell the stories that I had collected and with the guides and everything. The guides tell the stories. And one guide is talking. He's got his back to the building, and he's like, "Oh, man, I lost these people. They're not even paying attention to my story. What's going on?" And he asked him, he says, "Is there something wrong?" And one of the people said, "There are people in that building." Now, this is at 10 o'clock at night, okay? And it was an insurance company. Everybody left at 5. And he looked across the lake, and sure enough, you could see people looking out the window from inside. And he said, "That's strange. Nobody's supposed to be in there." And so all these, the brave tourists on this tour said, "Well, why don't we send these little kids over there to see what's going on?" So they sent 3 little kids, you know, 9, 10 years old, over there because they were across the street. So they went over. And it's an August night. It's a hot August night. And kids are over there. And they're looking at the windows. And they're watching things going on in there. So they turned around and came back across the street. And they said, there are soldiers in there. And the parents, you know, grabbed the little kids. And they were ice cold. The kids were cold to the touch. So everybody's taking pictures now of this building, but nobody would go over there. They said that they saw one man leaning against a soldier leaning against the mantelpiece. They saw another soldier that was sitting down, looked like he was sitting at a table eating, but there was no table there. And another one that kept looking out the window. In other words, he'd lean out and look out the window and then lean back. And it lasted for about 45 minutes because another tour came up, another one of my tours came up, and they told him, "Look in there, what do you see?" And they're saying, "Well, we see people moving around." So they took photographs too. I don't know if anyone got a video of these guys, but I've seen the photographs, and you can definitely see figures in that building that are, you know, they're definitely figures in that building. So I have seen a lot of and taken a lot of photographs where some of them I just have to call anomalies because I'm not sure what exactly they are, but others that are pretty much identifiable as people and sometimes soldiers.
Now, out of the videos that you have not obviously taken or people taken in your group, I'm assuming you've searched. And yes, you have to be careful, like you said, especially nowadays with technology and people with Photoshop and abilities to put, like you said, that app, ghosts, in anything. Same thing with other supernatural stuff, like UFOs, for instance. Nowadays, kind of paying attention to video evidence is not the same as it was, say, 30 years ago. But what have you seen of other people's videos, maybe people that you haven't even talked to or let alone come across paths with, but have seen videos that you think are legitimate? As for instance, before the interview, just before I talked to you, if you recall, I was telling you about this 2-minute video that I had seen. And I know it wasn't connected to you. I was just searching for Civil War ghosts and Gettysburg ghost in particular. And it showed this figure coming off from the right side. And he was clearly an aberration in the sense that he was sort of glowing and you could see through him. And he was like almost walking towards the road and just disappeared. Now, that to me was startling. And the people's reactions in it seemed genuine. Could it be hoaxed? Absolutely. I mean, what can't be these days? But what have you seen that has gotten you excited is the best way to say it.
Well, I've had a chance to work with, ghost hunters and ghost adventurers.
Yes.
And a couple of things that they did, These are guys who have really good equipment. And the one that I saw, I think it was Ghost Adventures, which is Zach Baggins and his crew. We kind of got a permission to go out to a place called a Railroad Engine House. We're good friends with the people we had a ghost train that we ran from that engine house. And, it is on the part of the battlefield that is, if there's any burials still there on the Gettysburg battlefield, it would be that spot, be in that area, because it became kind of like the backwater, abandoned after the first day's battle there, and no one got back to it. So burials would have been by farmers, and their headboards would have been knocked down by the cows, and before you know it, the graves have just disappeared. And so I think there still may be, if there are any burials still unfound out there in the battlefield, that would be it. At any rate, it's they had set up out there and had set their video camera up. And I'm fairly familiar with it, I thought where they were firing their camera, where it was aimed, was headed towards town. And sure enough, you could see a figure probably 30 yards from the camera come walking along, cross the tracks, and head over to the other side of the tracks. And I'm like, well, I'm going to call BS on this one, because the college is over here to the left. It was 2:00 in the morning. There are some apartments over on the right. And so this guy was just going home from a party. And then I got there and was talking to the people at the engine house, the guys that worked there. And I said, well, yeah, that's what, he said, no. He didn't have his camera going down those tracks. He said he had him going down and he turned to the left 90 degrees. He said, this camera was pointed down these tracks. That's a whole different thing, because on the left where I saw the figure coming from is not the college, but it was residential area, and not much of a residential, only maybe one house there. And the battlefield. So nobody's going to be coming from there at 2:00 in the morning. And across the tracks, almost immediately, is what they call at the college, the quarry, which was a quarry and is filled up with water. In other words, it wasn't a place that anybody should have been coming from. There was no place to go on the other side. So I'm really convinced that they got something, probably a soldier, the spirit of a soldier, with pretty good equipment that I wasn't faked, as far as I know. Same thing happened to me with Jason Hawes.
Yes.
They had some really good stuff. And when they showed me these, because I was kind of like the client, you know, they were trying to find and they showed me one. And the reason I believe that what they put on was legitimate because I saw it. They asked me about some other things, and I looked at them and I said, you know, Jason, I don't think these are. I think that might be the lights from a car going by, what you're seeing there. And he said, okay. And they did not use that. It was dramatic, but they did not use it on their show because, you know, they didn't want to use it because there was some doubt. But the other stuff, they had a good picture of, once again, a figure in the distance walking across a road and then just vanishing. You can literally see it disappear. And when they went down to examine where it was, I mean, there's no place for him to go, no place for him to disappear into. So that was pretty, those are some pretty impressive things that I've seen over the years.
That actually describes that video that I was telling you before, where that figure starts to walk and vanishes just literally out of thin air. Now, let me ask you this. Are there any factors that may contribute to a higher activity of ghosts being present, or it just doesn't matter? It just, you know, maybe a certain, well, obviously locations have to matter. Obviously the energy has to matter, but maybe is it sometimes bring in a medium may create more high strangeness or anything like that? What would you say about that?
Well, we use medium sometimes just to feed me information. I am not sensitive, okay, at all. You know, I don't, but the mediums will say, I think there's a Confederate soldier here, and so that's what I'll address. But as far as, you know, why ghosts linger, I mean, other than the obvious traditional things, you know, well, a horrible death or youthful death or something undone, left undone, that type of thing, that has to do with the person. There may be something that has to do with the environment as well. What I keep asking myself, what is it at Gettysburg, like the water at Fredericksburg, what is it at Gettysburg that captures the energy of these spirits and holds them here and then seems to replay them periodically? And the only thing I can think of, if you've ever been to Gettysburg, you realize that there's a lot of granite there. I mean, Devil's Den is boulders that are bigger than a building that are all scattered around. If you look at all the walls, the field walls made out of field stone, most of the foundations for the buildings, ours and almost all of them, are built or made out of the field stone, the gray granite. And I was thinking, well, you know, could the granite have something to do with it? Well, sure enough, a little research told me that granite holds quartz. Quartz is a very, very large part of granite.
And I heard a conductor, a huge conductor too, right?
Not only that, but what's in my computer that is capturing all this electricity and tons and tons of it, so that, you know, I can, you know, it has a memory. Well, it's quartz. It's a silicon. And, you know, it's kind of a crazy thought, but maybe that's what's captured all that energy that was expended. And periodically, spontaneously, it releases it. And that's why we get visions or sounds of the battle, or visions or sounds of actually individuals as well. So that's one thought, one theory that I've been exploring over the years. And it makes more sense now in the digital age, you know, that we have chips that hold, you know, thousands of photographs that are, you can hold in your hand. What happens when you have all this energy released, all this granite and quartz all around? Now, the only thing we have to do now, Dr. J, is figure out, you and me have to figure out a way how we can get the images released when we want them to be released. You know, what button is press escape, you know, or do you, what button do you hit? And then we can study these things, but I, you know, who knows if that's ever going to happen, but that's the one thought I had about that. Then again, there's the portal. It could be that Gettysburg, since historically we know it was a battlefield, and in you know, an American, a Native American battlefield, and then it was another battlefield again. You know, is there some kind of portal there that maybe releases the energies from another dimension?
Yes, that's what I was going to say. That's what a portal would be, exactly. And you, it has to be considered that these ghosts do live in another dimension and only are appearing in our dimension when they come through this portal. I mean, that's just a theory, but it's a darn good one. A very, very good explanation from what I've considered and my interest in ghosts literally goes back as far as my interest in UFOs goes, and that's over 30 years and almost as long as you've been doing this professionally. And I was just much younger at the time. You know, 30 years ago, I was a mere 9-year-old. But the point is obviously I've always been drawn to any books or documentaries on, for instance, sightings or anything that had to do with UFOs, ghosts, and anything of the paranormal. And that's why a lot of people actually talk about the topics collectively. You know, anything that has to do with cryptozoology, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, ghosts, UFOs. Some people think that or adopt the, I don't want to say feeling, but the theory that they're all sort of connected. Have you ever considered that?
Oh, yeah, I have a couple of friends who talk about that. For example, with Bigfoot, might be an interdimensional creature. In other words, comes through a portal and then disappears back into it. UFOs. I don't know how they could be from another solar system without having figured out some kind of dimensional travel. I mean, you know, time just doesn't, you know, do the math. You can't get there in enough, you know, the speed of light and everything can't get there in enough time to still be alive.
No, it would have to be. It would absolutely have to be. And that's why a lot of the UFOs sort of blink out. And you know what? I got to say, I am absolutely impressed with what you just said, Mark, because it's almost like you're telepathic, because literally earlier before I spoke to you, I was speaking to another great guest, Richard Shaw, who is the producer and filmmaker of the Watcher series. And we were just talking about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and Yeti, depending on where they are in the world. And that's exactly what he said, that they must be coming in and out of portals because they're so elusive. Why haven't we come across a body of one? Right. We see tracks. We've seen video. We've seen pictures. We've heard the sounds. But yet you never find a corpse. Well, I'm assuming because they're being elusive. And when he said that, of course, that's what I've always believed. And for you to say it, too, that's just phenomenal that we're all on the same page. So, you know, kudos to you, Mark. Definitely kudos to you. Now, we have a little over 10 minutes left, but we have a lot more to talk about. So let me get as much as I can. Now, I've interviewed people from Ghost Adventures and also the Ghost Hunters, and I've also been on Beyond Reality Radio with Jason Hawes and JV. So I got to hear their perspectives. How many times would you say the two of the series come and investigated with you on those different areas and the battlefields of not just Gettysburg, but the other battlefields?
Well, I know Jason came to Gettysburg at least twice. I worked with him once. The other time they spent out at the Cashtown Inn, which is about 7 miles outside of Gettysburg, but still associated with the battle, because Robert E. Lee passed by there in about 3/4 of the Confederate Army came by there. And it's a very haunted place. I know they went there. And then Ghost Adventures was at Hunterstown, which is several miles, a couple miles north of Gettysburg. And there was a battle there, too. And I worked with them out there. So, you know, it's kind of few and far between when I get to see them, but they're always, you know, a lot of fun to be with and pretty professional when they really, you know, when they get down to business.
And not to mention, you said the equipment they have. I mean, especially if it's paid for by the networks, you know, it definitely, they have a lot of equipment. That's, let's just say that. And you being on the production side, being there with them, got to see a lot more than me, who's only see what they do on TV, and of course talk to them on and off air. So I could only imagine what you would have thought seeing the equipment they have capturing the EVPs and FLIR. I don't know if they use FLIR, but I know they obviously have, like you said, the camera, the high spectrum or the different ranges that it could capture, from ultraviolet to, I don't even know what the other end is, but the point is far past what our eyes can see.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they have the good equipment. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And like you said, someone else is paying for it.
yeah, exactly. And someone else who can afford big bucks, meaning A&E, and I think it's, I don't know what the other network is. It's Sci-Fi.
History Channel, yeah.
History Channel is owned by A&E, and they got buku books, to say the least. Yeah, yeah. Now, let me ask you about names of soldiers. Have you ever there's two parts to this. First of all, have you ever found the name of a ghost and tracked down and found the actual grave of that soldier?
Yeah, that's happened a couple of times.
Interesting.
Yeah, maybe the most famous is General Reynolds, and he is about the only one that I have a ghost story or a couple of ghost stories about that I have identified at Gettysburg. He was killed on the first day, 15 minutes after he got there. Major General,
wow,
highest ranking officer. Later on, I get a story from this is, you know, more contemporary, from a seminarian. Who told me about seeing an image, being awakened by an image in the middle of the night. And he described the guy, dark face, dark uniform, and a big, heavy beard. And when I showed him a photograph of Reynolds, he said, that's him. Later on, then, he has also been seen at another place where called the George House. The guy's name was the same. And in that house, people had looked in the window at night and seen a body lying out on a cot and a young woman there crying. And it was like they thought at first it was wax figures. When they went in the next day to ask the people, the store owners, about the wax figures, the people were like, what are you talking about? There are no wax figures here, obviously. And they said, well, no, we saw right in the fact. In that wall was a door. Well, they pointed at a wall that was covered with cloth, and you couldn't see it, you know. So they opened up the cloth, and there was a door back there. So, and they described Reynolds to a T, and it just so happened that that was the house that John Reynolds was taken to before his body was taken back to Philadelphia to lie in state. So I'm pretty sure that he comes back to Gettysburg periodically. Of course, he was a professional officer. His life was cut short. He only got 15 minutes into the battle when he was killed.
That actually shocks the heck out of me, actually. If you hear that, I don't understand how they can get to a general. I would think the general would be really at the back of the army, military.
Back in those days, the generals led their troops. And you're right, he was a major general. That's pretty high up. And he was right in the front, scouting out where his troops were supposed to be and calling to them. He turned, and a mini ball hit him right in the back of the head. Oof. And killed him virtually instantly.
You
and
actually,
his body was.
Go ahead, finish.
Well, his body then was taken through where that dormitory eventually was built, through the area where the dormitory, where that seminarian saw him. So was it on the path that his body was taken? Was it exactly on the path? It may very well have been. So
you actually answered the next question when I said there's two parts. And the next question would have been, what was the highest ranking ghost you had spoken to from the Civil War? I'm assuming, based on what you just said, it's General Reynolds.
General Reynolds, yeah. Now, you know what? That's interesting. I haven't gotten EVP from Reynolds. I might try that next time I'm out there. But he was the highest ranking officer to be killed in the Battle of Gettysburg. It was pretty quick. I mean, you know, shot right in the back of the head, and there were people around him because he had aides and people to help him out, couriers and everything. So,
you know, honestly, it's been a fantastic interview, Mark, and I truly look forward to having you back on. I know we can go on and on and on about this, considering you've written 8 books, coming out with a 9th book. When your 9th book is about to be released, please do let us know. If you have, before I ask you to plug in all your information, and by the way, when we finish this interview, if you can hang tight for us to get clear so we can talk off air real quick, what would be a final statement that you give to everybody out there, believers, non-believers alike? What would you say?
Well, I would say, you know, come to Gettysburg, because there is a certain feeling, a certain aura about the place. Even if you're a non-believer, you're going to get a feeling there. Everybody does. And I kind of liken it to what it like walking into a church. You know, it's just a building, but you get a weird feeling. You get a special feeling when you're there. That's how Gettysburg is. And it may very well be that, it's the spirits that we're feeling, that kinship between from soul to soul, between the living souls and the dead souls. But you really have to come to Gettysburg to appreciate it, I think.
Well said. Now let's talk about where people can find you, where they can contact you for your tours and purchase your books.
The easiest way is to go to our website, ghostsofgettysburg.com. And it's plural, Ghosts of Gettysburg. I think there's another one out there that's singular. So you want to get to several ghosts, ghostsofgettysburg.com. And from that website, you can get information on our tours. You can order books. You can order T-shirts, all kinds of neat stuff. And find out information. For example, we're putting on Haunted Crime Scenes Weekend. April 26th to the 28th, we wrote a book called Haunted Crime Scenes. We present you with a crime. We don't tell you what it is beforehand. Then we tell you how to investigate the crime using paranormal techniques, teach you how to do that. And you'll be in a haunted B&B, so that's one thing we're doing. I just came out with a work of fiction called Die Again Once More. And it's out now, and it's available on Amazon, and it kind of is based on some of the experiences that I've had and written about at Gettysburg. And of course, Ghosts of Gettysburg 9 will be announced as soon as it comes out on that website. So, you know, and then we've got our season coming up, our tour season, which should start end of March, early April. So
throughout the summer, I would think, right? Especially at the anniversary.
All summer long. We run 7 days a week in the summertime, and then actually run tours on weekends all the way through Thanksgiving.
Well, you know, I'd be honored to take a tour, and it saddens me to say that I have yet to beat at any of the battleground states, and literally to be an American and not have been to Gettysburg is sort of a shame. I guess that's what happens when you get stuck in Southern California. Anyhow, Mark, I want to thank you, everybody. Mark Nesbitt, please check out his website, go on his tours, read his books. There's so many. As we were on this interview, Mark, I got to say, I was looking for that image that you had from Jeff Ritzman that you mentioned, and I could not find it, but I did come across another book that you co-wrote with, I don't even remember her name, but it was another female. But the point was, is there's a lot just by searching even your name or anything like that. So it's a true honor. Now, let me give some shout outs and some thanks. First of all, I want to thank the station owner, UPRN, United Public Radio Network, 107.7 FM, New Orleans, Joe Montaldo. Also, Deprogram Radio in the United Kingdom. I want to thank JC. Also, on my team, we have to thank Joshua Cheris, who is my assistant producer and VP of operations and assistant to so many other things, and Pam Vrettenberg, social media manager, and she's also the owner of UnitedTruthSeekers.com, a website that covers all aspects of this and so many other things. With that being said, folks, remember, keep an open mind. It literally, you have to take all this information, and please just don't be passive listeners and viewers, depending on what medium you're paying attention to, how we're conducting this interview. And take this information and do something about it. Become proactive. If we had more people just like we do with Mark, then I think the answers, because there's so many questions, especially when you're dealing with something that has passed away and still is visiting us to this day for whatever reason, attachments, like we said, the energy, maybe that's the location they passed away because of the veterans that lived and kept coming back because of the memories being so strong. There are so many different explanations and or questions that require explanations, and we could only go so far with the equipment we have of the day, and it's better than it was 50 years ago, but we're getting somewhere, and so that's what I ask of all of you, to keep an open mind. With that being said, folks, I'm Dr. J. I wish you all a good night in the U.S., U.S., Canada, Mexico, and in the U.K., EU, and everywhere else. I wish you a good morning. And now I am officially signing off.
Mornings. You hit that snooze button at least 3 times. Then you rushed out the door with mismatched socks and an empty stomach. Sounds like someone needs to add some sizzle to their morning routine. Like a delicious breakfast sandwich from Mickey D's. Made fresh with hot and savory sausage. And now, get a sausage McGriddles, sausage McMuffin, or sausage biscuit for just $1 each. That's right. Get your morning sizzle back with 3 great breakfast sandwiches for $1 each only at McDonald's. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.
Here today, gone today? The pace of change can be confusing. Then again, it can be inspiring. Every year, Harvard Business School Executive Education helps executives like you build the self-confidence and decision-making skills it takes to thrive on change. Fight change with change. Go. Start by going to hbs.me/go. That's hbs.me/go.